It's Monday morning. I'm Dean Rothbart. This week, I'm pleased to share with you an interview that I conducted as part of a multi-year project that I've been working on since the fall of last year. The project, News Luminaries, entails taking the oral histories of dozens of the 21st century's most influential journalists, both active and retired. These oral histories will be divided into two categories, luminaries and visionaries. The luminaries are those women and men who have had or are having exemplary careers. The visionaries are also luminaries, but their contributions to the journalism profession have left an indelible positive mark on the way their peers or other news organizations conduct themselves. As many of the listeners to this podcast know, for many years I've reported on the journalism profession for my newsletter, the TJFR Business News Reporter, and for my Profiles Service News Bios. Back in March 2000, I had the pleasure of hosting a gala dinner in the Grand Ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria that honored the 100 top business journalists of the 20th century. The event raised money to help fund a permanent chair in business journalism at the University of Missouri. Well, amazingly, it's almost 20 years since that event, and so much has changed in the world of journalism, both for better and worse. Nowadays, journalists come in for a lot of criticism, and that often overshadows the enormous good that the news media continue to do to inform us and to expose wrongdoing and wrongdoers. The News Luminary and Business News Visionary Awards are intended as a counterbalance to all of that negativity that surrounds the news media. And I'm proud to be the chair of both projects. Last fall, I began taking the oral histories of prominent journalists. This week's guest here on Monday Morning Radio, Steve Sansweet, is one of my News Luminary recipients. His career at the Wall Street Journal from 1969 to 1996 included stints as a reporter, foreign correspondent, and for many years, the Los Angeles bureau chief. For journalism junkies like me, Steve's oral history is fascinating in its own right. But it is his post-journalism career that I think listeners to this podcast will find most relevant and illuminating. Steve, a rabid Star Wars fan and collector, left the Journal to join Lucasfilm as director of content management and head of fan relations. He worked there full-time for 15 years, planning fan conventions and speaking at them, as well as serving as an in-house editor of licensed Star Wars fan magazines. For another 6-plus years, Steve worked as a consultant to Lucasfilm in a variety of capacities. In November 2011, then officially retired, Steve made the bold move to open his own Star Wars memorabilia museum, which he calls Rancho Obi-Wan. Located in Petaluma, California, the not-for-profit Rancho Obi-Wan displays a portion of Steve's ginormous treasure chest of Star Wars collectibles. Steve's collection is so large and so impressive that Guinness World Records crowned it the world's largest private collection of Star Wars memorabilia. Back in early December, my guest on this podcast was Ryan McFarland, a successful entrepreneur, head of Strider Sports International, who created his own 501c3 nonprofit foundation to oversee his all-kids bike movement, which aims to teach every child in America how to bike before they reach the first grade. As I noted at the time, a growing number of small business owners are creating nonprofit entities to buttress their philanthropic efforts. Steve Sansweet is another example of this. He could have opened Rancho Obi-Wan to enrich his bank account and if he wanted, he could auction off some or all of his collection, which he still owns and only lends to the museum, likely for millions of dollars. But Steve and Ryan McFarland and Roy and Penny Williams, who built the nonprofit Amazing Wizard Academy, are rich in other ways. Their lives have purpose, they are inspired to share their good fortune with others, and they have created organizations that will serve as legacies for generations. By the way, for those of you who are interested in my news luminaries and business news visionaries projects, their official debut is scheduled for Thursday, March 12th. Each week thereafter, I intend to post a fresh oral history with a luminary or a visionary. The collection of oral histories, along with exclusive photo portraits of the honorees, taken by my daughter Avital, will be available at www.newsluminaries.com. I'll have more about this to share with you in the weeks ahead. But now, excerpts from my News Luminaries conversation with Steve Sansweet, President and CEO of Rancho Obi-Wan Inc. Steve, it is a true pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
My pleasure, Dean.
And so, Steve, just to start out, you were taken with Star Wars from the time that you were a kid. What captivated you? What captivates you about Star Wars?
Well, I was a 31-year-old kid.
Oh, okay. That's true. I guess that's true. That's right. That's true. Go ahead.
I grew up loving science fiction and fantasy and just read all the great authors in the 50s and 60s and watch the cheesy movies and some of the TV shows and things like that. Then I had started a small collection of space toys, of rockets and robots, mainly from Japan, toys that were out there in the 50s and 60s through the 70s. Then we got an invitation at the Wall Street Journal Los Angeles office for journalists to come and see a new movie that they were finally high on after being very, very dubious about for a couple of years. And it was called Star Wars. And it was about 2 weeks before the movie opened, before any of the hype had started. And I got swept away, like many of the other people in that auditorium at the back lot of 20th Century Fox. I think it's the fairly simple story of good versus evil, the mythological underpinnings, the special effects, which were amazing for its day, and it all came together in a package that was electrifying and was different than so many of the movies that had come out in the 70s. And it changed a lot of things, and one of those things that it changed was my life. Who would have thought that?
Did you know it by the end of the screening? Did you say that in some way this was changing who you are?
I felt something, that's for sure.
It was the Force.
Yes, I think it does exist. I went up to the head of PR at Fox and said, first thing, give me my movie pass back. I want to keep it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I said, I think you've got something really hot here. And he said, yeah, I think the guys on the board of directors are finally breathing a sigh of relief because they didn't know what they had until fairly recently. As a result of that screening and one they had done in New York, the stock price went up. We had a column in the Herd in the Street about 20th Century Fox and this new movie that everybody was talking about. And sure enough, it opened to only on 32 screens, but to a large audience and attracted the media. It got all kinds of attention, and the rest was history.
So you were bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal in Los Angeles from 1987 until 96. If I had come to your office or your cubicle during that period, would it have been overflowing with Star Wars memorabilia?
No, I really kept all of that at home.
Okay.
It wasn't any surprise to
the men and women who worked with me inform me that I was a Star Wars junkie, and I started writing Star Wars books in the 90s. When the time came to leave the Journal, and I told them, and then I told them where I was going, which was to Lucasfilm, everybody sort of said, oh, well.
Two things that differentiate you from most journalists. One is, when most journalists start a second career, it's either in public relations or they're writing books. In some ways, it was somewhat daring for you to start a second career, to initially go work for Lucas. Did you have trepidation about doing that?
Well, it's funny. I mean, the job offer came in a very strange kind of way. It was the head of publicity who approached me and said, Steve, we're looking for somebody for a one-year-only job, and guaranteed to only last a year. And we want somebody to go around and talk to fans about the special editions of the three movies, the original three movies coming up. And the salary was about a third of what I made at the Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the kind of thing where nobody in their right mind would accept a job like that. So naturally, I did. As Joseph Campbell, the famed author and myth maker and the guy who's written so much, who wrote so much about the mythology, and said that I followed my bliss.
Mm-hmm. When you first arrived at Lucasfilms, how close to the inner circle were you? Was this something where every day you saw George Lucas and the top team? Was this something where once a month you got shuffled in and shuffled out? How did that work?
No, in fact, for the first year, I sort of worked out of my house in Los Angeles. I didn't even move up to Northern California for another couple of years. Basically, they would have been happy if I had gone out to maybe 10 fan conventions, and I went out to about 40 during the year, and not just in the U.S., but all over the world, and started building up a reputation. Lucasfilm really sort of pioneered fan relations back when the movie first came out, back in 1977, and even before that, they had somebody aboard who was head of marketing and licensing, and he had about five or six titles, and he was a comic book geek, and he went out there and he said, we've got to appeal to the fans, because I don't trust 20th Century Fox and how they're going to market this movie. And he went out to these nascent fan conventions, like San Diego Comic-Con, which now attracts maybe 160,000, 170,000 people every summer, and back then was only in its sixth year, and said, you know, we've got to go there and talk to the fans and get them interested and excited about the comic book that's coming out for Star Wars, and but mainly the movie. Anything we can do to help market the movie would be great. So we did about four or five fan conventions in 76, and then Lucasfilm, once the success of Star Wars was assured, Lucasfilm started a licensed fan club and then within a year brought it in-house and really continued that through 1986 and really sort of established what a licensed fan club and fan relations for a movie company could be. Of course, it's different having one or two titles, I mean, Star Wars and Indiana Jones, and releasing 20 disparate movies a year. You really can concentrate on things. But Lucasfilm, from the beginning, just made sure that they really were fan-friendly and answered letters of any fan letter that was sent in was answered, and that exists to this day. It's a pretty amazing setup for basically a small company.
Yep.
And so I didn't work with, I would go up to headquarters maybe once every month or every 2 months and talk, and they just forgot to get rid of me after a year, and I stayed on for 15. So one of those things that happens, you sort of take that risk because it's something that you really want to do.
Steve, I have two theories about you. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive, and they may not be right. But one is that you have talents and personality characteristics that made you succeed as a journalist and also have allowed you to succeed in your second life. or two is that the talents you have as a journalist overlaid very nicely on the responsibilities and opportunities that came about once you joined Lucasfilm. And I, as I said, I know they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but what do you think? Do you think that had you never worked for the Journal, because of just who you are, how you think, you would have been equally successful with Lucasfilms and now in your own endeavor? Or do you think that, in fact, what you learned as a journalist and as a manager, as a bureau chief, has been crucial to the what you're doing with Rancho Obi-Wan?
No, the latter, definitely. It was crucial. I learned a lot of skills. And I think you're right. It's partly my personality. And in the early years of my life, I sort of considered myself an introvert. And I think one of the reasons I went into journalism was to try to become more of an extrovert. There are very few successful journalists who are introverts. It's the kind of profession where you really need to put yourself out there, from everything from going out in those early days at the Philadelphia Inquirer when the lists came in from the Vietnam War and you had to go get someone's photograph because they had died in the war. And that's not easy to do for an introvert.
Oh, definitely.
But the parents or the spouse would always, you know, despite their grief, they would always want to make sure that their loved one's photo appeared in print. And so it sounds like the worst possible thing and the biggest intrusion you could possibly do. But you learn that this is important to them as much as it is to the general public. Working and getting a staff that reports to you and being a mentor, I think, really helped me in my career at Lucasfilm, especially when I started hiring some people and mentored them at Lucasfilm. So the Journal was an essential part of my life, and I think the reporting and the abilities, the skills that you develop as a reporter are transferable to many other kinds of jobs, and especially in something that is so closely related to marketing, publicity, and just dealing with other people.
I mentioned earlier that you are different than many journalists in two respects. The second respect, Steve, is you've had more experience than most journalists ever will of being the subject of news and feature coverage. People writing about you, usually positively, but not always. What have you learned about our profession from being the subject of news coverage?
Well, it's been tough. I'll tell you, when the shoe sort of went on the other foot and people wanted to interview me about Lucasfilm or things of that nature, and now running Rancho Obi-Wan, a nonprofit museum that houses the world's largest collection of Star Wars memorabilia, you have to sort of hope for the best. I mean, and I think I had the best at the Wall Street Journal on the other side with reporters who were just among the best in the world and really dedicated to quality journalism. And sometimes you can just tell by the way somebody approaches you that the story is not going to be that great. You also learn what to look out for when somebody asks to do an interview about X, Y, or Z, and you really don't want to talk about X, Y, or Z, or you don't want to talk about Y, or you decline to do the interviews. I mean, I'm usually the kind of guy who says yes to everything, but I have learned that that does not always pay off.
You know, this really is just a thought experiment, but now if for some strange reason you went back and you became bureau chief again at the Wall Street Journal, having now seen what it feels like to be the, and you're right, I mean, the caliber of Wall Street Journal reporters, maybe I should send you back to some other news organization.
No, don't.
Okay. I wonder whether you would instruct your reporters or editors or you yourself might change somewhat now knowing what it feels like to be on the other side.
I think it gives you a little more empathy. And there are situations I might have handled a little bit differently. I can remember one particular instance when one of my reporters, a very good one, was covering the Hollywood beat and came up with a story about a subsidiary of a large entertainment company named Walt Disney Company was rebelling and was going to go try to leave the Walt Disney Company. It was Miramax and Harvey Weinstein and his brother. I got this call out of the blue from Michael Eisner, who was then the chairman and CEO of Disney, saying that my reporter was absolutely wrong. It was BS, and we were going to look foolish if we published the story. And I said, you know, Michael, I think, you know, I trust my reporter. He tells me his sources are very good on this one. And I says, well, I'm telling you it's crap, and hangs up the phone on me. And then about 5 minutes later, the phone rings again, and it's his secretary saying in a very trepidatious voice, it's Mr. Eisner on the phone for you. And he gets on the phone again and reads me the riot act. Goes on for another couple of minutes, hangs up again, and then a third time, a few minutes later, calls back by himself and just says, I want to tell you, the Walt Disney Company is not going to talk to the Wall Street Journal again, and bang.
Wow.
So, wow. This was 6 months after he'd come back to the company after suffering a heart attack. I was afraid he was going to have another one. So, of course, I called the boss in New York and said, you know, I just want you to know that I've gotten some unusual calls here from a top executive, and this is the story. And I went back to my reporter and asked him a little more closely who his sources were on the story. He felt comfortable. It's also possible in retrospect that the story was accurate from a certain point of view, and not from Eisner's point of view, and that it's possible that we were being led a little for certain purposes.
Yep.
But, you know, we went with what we had, and we went with a well-sourced story, and we went with Disney's denials, and it turned out not to be true in the immediate future, but it turned out to be true 2 years later. It was the same dynamic that would have caused the split based on when we reported. We were just very prescient, I guess, 2 years out.
When I was at Dow Jones, and again, we overlap, but you were there longer than I ever was, it was still sort of a family-run business where I had a nice pension besides my salary. And when I left to start my company, the TGFR Group, where I did the newsletter and whatnot, I was able to fund it, self-funded by just basically cashing in my Dow Jones stock, because I didn't buy it, I just got it as part of being there.
Right.
Where did you get the money? Were you just like, to start really enlarging your Star Wars collectibles collection?
I'm not married and don't have kids, and I spent a lot of my money over the years buying Star Wars stuff directly from, you know, the stores and the catalogs. And when eBay came along in the 90s, that was a place to go. It was as much entertainment as it was anything else. In the late 1980s, when Star Wars was sort of quiescent, a number of people with super large collections decided to sell them. Two of them because they were getting divorced and had to monetize their collections for the divorce. And I bought large chunks of those three collections. And, you know, I saved money going along, and the stock came in handy when I left the Journal for that 1 year of one-third salary at Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
It helped support me, and I was also writing a book at the time, the first Star Wars encyclopedia, and that was taking much longer to write than I thought it would. I had to read all of the books that had been published, all of the novels, all of the comics, all of the young adult books, and really do an extensive encyclopedia. And so I would do that during the week and go out to fan conventions across the country on the weekends and then come back and work on the book again. So it was partially that helped me make the decision to go, and I said, I've got to finish this book.
By the time you left Lucasfilm, had your salary, compensation, gotten back or even gone higher than it had been at the Journal?
It finally got back and went a little higher than the Journal, okay. But it was never a huge amount more. Yeah, no, that was not the reason I went there.
I get that. The reality of it is, and, you know, I don't know your personal lifestyle, and it's none of my business, and I don't know other things, but the reality of it is, if you wanted to cash in on all of the collectibles that you acquired over the years, I suspect you could be much wealthier than you are. Instead, you opened up a not-for-profit, a non-profit business, Rancho Obi-Wan. Explain that.
Well, looking at the collection and knowing that I'd be leaving Lucasfilm in about a year, sometime early in 2010, I was talking with my associate, someone who had come here to help catalog the collection, a lady named Ann Newman, who lived in Texas and volunteered to come and catalog the collection at no cost.
That's, wow.
I mean, she's a database expert and a fellow Star Wars fan, and she wanted to work with me. And we arranged to find a place at Rancho Obi-Wan for her to live and said, you know, let's see how long this lasts. Let's see how it goes. And in early 2010, we talked about, you know, what's the future here. It was my private collection. It was in a former chicken coop, a giant barn, or two barns, really, that housed 20,000 chickens up until the early 1970s. The first one had been converted into a warehouse. And we talked about, well, you know, we could do a museum. There had been nothing like that, and do it as a nonprofit. Becoming a nonprofit is a lot more difficult than I ever thought it would be. I mean, there's paperwork that says it takes 12 days to fill out, and it really takes a month to, because you not only have to fill out the paperwork, you have to come up with a board of directors, discrimination policies, and other kinds of policies for even the smallest nonprofit. It was quite a feat that fell on Anne, but we both decided that this would be what I would do in retirement and run a nonprofit museum. And that's when we also decided to convert the second barn building into part of the museum. So it's now about 9,000 square feet of space for the exhibits and another 7,000 square feet of off-site rental warehouse. There's a lot of stuff.
It does.
I don't know where it all came from.
It does sound that way. So where do the funds for operations come from? Is it from admissions? Do you sell off any of the collection?
Yeah, over the years, and mainly before it became a nonprofit, because the collection still belongs to me, I lease it to the nonprofit for zero a year. I lease the building to the nonprofit for $0 a year. But the nonprofit also takes care of maintenance and electrical and gas and things of that nature.
When people come to me and make me what I consider absurd offers for various pieces in the collection, I have, in fact, over the years, sold pieces. There was one particular piece, I won't say exactly what it was, that I purchased years ago for $400 that I sold for six figures.
So I know nothing, or next to nothing, Steve, about Star Wars collectibles. I mean, I know enough as an outsider to know that there's a huge appetite for it. But what is the holy grail? Not in your collection necessarily, although maybe it is in your collection. What is the holy grail, or what are two or three items that would be considered the holy grail of Star Wars collectors?
Well, there is a holy grail, or a couple of holy grails, and the character Boba Fett, the bounty hunter who appeared in The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, there was an action figure that was released in 1979 as a sort of preview figure to The Empire Strikes Back, or you could send away for it, and it was supposed to have a rocket-firing backpack. and the rocket was a small plastic missile, maybe an inch and a half long. And the problem was that around the same time, Mattel Toys had put out a Battlestar Galactica set of toys,
and there were missiles in its spaceships. And one of these small missiles choked a child. And so the whole choke tube size for kids' toys came into being. And Kenner, which was doing the toys for Star Wars, tried to figure out some way of making their missile still fireable for its toy, because that's the way they had advertised it. And they tried a couple of versions, one with a locking mechanism, which really wasn't too sturdy, but the problem was the size of the missile. So kids got in the mail their action figure months later, and it had a sonic welded missile in the backpack with no spring and no firing mechanism. Everybody remembers the disappointment. There was a note to consumers and all of that. Well, there were prototypes of the firing toy, two distinct kinds, one with something called an L slot and one with something called a J slot that was a locking mechanism. Well, the L slot, earlier this year, one of the L slots sold at auction for $115,000, and one of the J slots just sold this month, earlier this month, for $185,000.
Yeah.
These are 3 3/4 inches of plastic. I've got both of those in my collection.
Is there anything that you don't have in your collection that you know exists that you would love to have?
There's plenty of stuff, but no, I don't have any holy grail myself. I made the mistake once on a very early interview that I did on the collection in the 1980s, talking about, well, I wish I had not passed up a Return of the Jedi bicycle from Toys R Us, and it was like $70. And within a couple of weeks of this article appearing in a magazine called Starlog, I got a call from a dealer on the East Coast and the West Coast, and they both had great news for me. They had a mint-in-the-box bicycle, and they both quoted the same price, $2,000.
Wow. Wow.
It was a $70 bicycle
two years
before.
Listen, I mean, you're talking about the Boba Fett.
I pass.
You're talking about the Boba Fett and what it could bring, and that's pretty amazing. A few more, if you don't mind, Rancho Obi-Wan questions for you. Tell me, what's going on with the George Lucas Star Wars Museum? Isn't it supposed to be in Chicago? I mean, I know there's a museum coming up, and have they wanted items from your collection?
Well, it's not a Star Wars museum.
Okay.
It's a museum, it's the Lucas Museum of Narrative Arts, and he has one of the world's largest private Norman Rockwell collections.
Okay.
And actually, Steven Spielberg has another Rockwell collection. But art that tells a story. And so there will be some Star Wars stuff in this museum, which is currently being built in Los Angeles,
Okay. Just
south of the University of Southern California campus.
Do you lend out parts of your collection, like to them or to other traveling exhibits or other things like that?
There's a biannual convention called Star Wars Celebration, which I helped start in 1999 when I was with the company. And for the last five of these, we've done exhibits. We've had a Rancho Obi-Wan booth, 2,400 square feet, where we bring items from the collection. Usually there's a theme involved, or several themes involved in what we bring. We'll be doing it again in August of 2020, and it's the 40th anniversary of The Empire Strikes Back, so we'll be doing it strictly on that. We've had an exhibit at the Perot Museum of Science and Industry in Dallas. Their opening internal show was something called Eye of the Collector, and they had collections from 11 people who collect strange or unusual objects, and we had a big, beautiful display case down there, maybe 75 or 80 of our objects. We've done exhibits for Target, which had a big event for The Force Awakens when the Star Wars movies came back under Disney, down at LA Live.
Wow.
And we supplied several hundred items for that. So, yeah, we do
exhibits and things of that nature.
Every time there's a new movie, I mean, do you then have to go out and buy every collectible related to the movie?
No, I've calmed down quite a bit, I must say. I've run low on money and completely out of space. So I buy what I like.
Okay.
There's still plenty of stuff coming in here practically every day. There's boxes. But the collectible buying comes out of my money and not the museum's money.
Yeah.
The way the museum makes money is we do tours on Saturdays, mostly done by docents. We have membership, which is $50 or $55 a year. And through that, people support us. Our goal is to inspire people and inspire. It's fun when we get people coming, couples and families, and there's a hardcore collector among them, but everybody else is coming along to, you know, just be friendly and helpful and supportive. But my biggest pleasure is seeing those people get a kick out of the collection, too, not understanding what they're about to see and what they're about to go through. And what we do is tours that last about 3 hours, and they're filled with stories. So my stories of how things were collected, what they mean, how they fit into the making of the movie or the selling of the movie, and just what Star Wars launched, how it turned things around in the movie business as far as production, as far as the selling of merchandise. Star Wars was a first in so many ways. And the fact that we're still talking about it 40 years later, plus, and we now have three generations of Star Wars fans, is pretty amazing. And it's a feat that few other movie-related entities can really claim.
When you said that one of your top missions is to inspire visitors, inspire them in which way, Steve? Inspire them to like Star Wars? Inspire them to be creative? What do you mean by inspire them?
It's the creativity, and that's one of the things I find about Star Wars fans, and one of the things that I've sort of specialized in the last 10 years is buying fan-made objects, beautiful art, three-dimensional objects. We had a 12-year-old girl who did pipe cleaner Star Wars figures and was at the county fair up here in Sonoma County. And one of our board of directors, one of our docents actually saw them there and slipped her a card, and they have ended up at Rancho Obi-Wan because then she had a place to put them. And they're just really beautiful. And it's things like that. It's the world's largest Star Wars painting is now here on long-term loan. It's a 15-foot by 8-foot canvas called 20th Century Space Fantasy by a San Francisco artist. We had it on display at one of our Star Wars celebration booths, and then he needed more space in his studio. And this is a piece that went up for sale for $200,000. He hasn't sold it yet, but if he sells it, I'll be happy to have him take it. But in the meantime, our visitors can see it and appreciate it. And
that's great.
It's an amazing piece.
Just a couple more quick ones, Steve, and then I'll let you go. One is, what is your response to Disney's Star Wars Galaxy's Edge?
I enjoyed it. It's definitely meant for older fans and adults. Not a lot for kids to do except buy stuff. And the cantina, of course, is a drinking establishment.
Right.
An adult drinking establishment. But I think they have captured the essence of Star Wars in this land where you really can't see the rest of the park from anywhere in it. I got goosebumps when I first went. I really liked it, and cool. I think it's going to develop into a long-term success for Disney.
So none of us know what happens in the afterlife, or if there is an afterlife. If there is, and it's populated with flesh and blood characters from Star Wars, who would you be most interested in meeting first?
Well, this is called Rancho Obi-Wan.
Okay.
I sort of love the Obi-Wan character because he was the mentor that I sort of became in real life. And we've both got beards.
In your days as a journalist, did you ever meet Alec Guinness?
Never met Alec Guinness. Met Ewan McGregor once on the set, but never Alec Guinness. I would have liked to, although in his latter years he became a little gruff about Star Wars because the kids always came up to him with Obi-Wan Kenobi pictures, and he had done so much more in his life. Of course, he made more money on the Star Wars movies than on everything else in his life that he had ever done.
Ultimately, when the Force does call you home, what happens to your collection?
Well, we have plans for it to pass on to the next generation, and you know whether that happens or not will be up to other people. But I have a plan of succession in line, and hopefully the museum will continue. It's a very different kind of situation because of where it's at in a town of 60,000. We are near San Francisco. We're 40 miles north of it. But you have to want to come here, and we've got people from all over the world. Disney especially has done contests with retailers and manufacturers everywhere from France to Vietnam to Dubai. And we've had visitors from all of those places because it's win a trip to Rancho Obi-Wan because you can't get into Skywalker Ranch.
Uh-huh.
And it's
second best.
Now they have Galaxy's Edge, so we'll see how many trips we get to Rancho Obi-Wan.
I think
they'll be pushing Galaxy's Edge a lot.
I guess the final question I want to ask you, just because if I don't, I know others will ask me why I didn't ask you. So what's your relationship like with George Lucas?
Well, we always had a very good relationship, and when I left the company, he signed a poster for me, and he said, looking at it now, it's on my office wall, it says, "To Steve, the ultimate fan, thanks for all the help. The Force is with you."
Very nice.
I couldn't ask for more than that.
No, it's very
nice. George is a great guy, and he is still very active. He's started a winery. He's purchased vineyards in France and Italy. It's turned into a big business. He's turned one of his office complexes in a small town in Marin County into a conference center, a high-end conference center with 50-plus rooms near the vineyards. He's building this billion-dollar museum for narrative art and a lot of educational components. He keeps very active and very involved.
Well, I'm looking for an appropriate Obi-Wan Kenobi quote to sign off with. I'm not sure I can find one. Here's one: "If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." Maybe that's not a bad quote. Steve, I've enjoyed talking to you about business, and I've enjoyed talking to you about journalism, and I've enjoyed talking to you about Star Wars. Terrific conversation. I just want to thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Dean, and good luck with the podcast.
You've been listening to Monday Morning Radio with Dean Rothbart. Be sure to read and subscribe to my weekly email column, The Monday Morning Memo, at mondaymorningmemo.com, where I share my observations on the world at large. Trends, tastes, marketing, advertising, small business, whatever else is on my mind. This is Roy H. Williams.
Good luck, all the best. Till we hear from you again.